Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Welcome back to All of It. The allegations against R. Kelly have garnered media attention over the last months and years, and rightfully so. But it's a story that goes back decades, particularly for one journalist. Music critic Jim DeRogatis was in an office of a Chicago Sun-Times when he got a fax. It began with the sentence, "I'm sending this to you because I don't know where else to go." At first, the anonymous note seemed to be about a review of an R. Kelly album and a comparison that DeRogatis had made between the music of Marvin Gaye and Robert Sylvester Kelly. That's the R&B star's real name. The message took a turn. It read, "I guess Marvin Gaye had problems too, but I don't think they were like Robert's. Robert's problem, and it's a thing that goes back many years, is young girls." DeRogatis received the letter just before Thanksgiving in the year of 2000. On December 21st of that year, the Chicago Sun-Times published his article, "Kelly Accused of Sex with Teenage Girls." In the nearly two decades since then, DeRogatis has relentlessly pursued and uncovered the allegations against Kelly. DeRogatis, who is also an associate professor at Columbia College and host of the radio show Sound Opinions, shares the story of his reporting in the book Soulless, The Case Against R. Kelly. We talked about it recently, and I began by asking Jim when, during the course of this reporting, he realized that he was going to commit to this story and see it through for as long as it took to get the truth.
When our first story ran, me and Abdon Palish was my reporting partner on December 21st, 2000. It was 6 weeks of 18-hour days. It took us to nail 7 days a week to nail that story. In between, you know, I'm still having to review records, review concerts, preview artists coming to town as pop music critic. Abdon's covering other court cases. But we thought this was really important. And with every young girl we spoke to and her mother and her family members, you know, we got more and more committed to doing this story right, because we saw the pain, we saw the metaphorical and lyrical scars on young women's wrists from where they tried to kill himself. I hate that headline, and I'm sorry you read it, R. Kelly's sex with teenagers. It can't be sex. It that implies right. Consensual. It was a statutory rape. It was an assault of a 14 or 15 year old who couldn't have consented. I don't know. It got its teeth in us. But we thought on December 21st, it's like, okay, we nailed this. We used, you know, everything we had to report this story. The world will stop this man. And I'm talking to you 19 years later, and he's in court now, but he's free. And there's two young women with him now whose families say are being abused, brainwashed, part of a cult, which sounds super melodramatic. And if I had not reported that story for 9 months, I would think it was nonsense, too.
Oh,
but
well,
it's not.
You know, with we're saying about NXIVM, I think people are actually are aware that these things are going on. It's interesting that you should mention that headline, because a big part of the book, or not a significant part of the book, is your struggle to have this story reported the way that you believe deeply should be reported, and details that are pushed down to the 30th graph and a 36th
yeah.
graph. You know, you really had to struggle to get people to pay attention to the seriousness of the story. And you've said that when you first started reporting on this, you received deafening silence. To what do you attribute that?
You know, the million-dollar quote, and to be clear, when I say this for the millionth time, and it can't be said often enough, I am simply amplifying what hundreds of young black women and girls have said to me. Nobody matters less in our society than black girls. And you know, I'm a 54-year-old fat white rock critic with a Rocky Erickson tattoo. We just taped a tribute to Rocky for Sound Opinions, you know, and many others. I'm not part of the South and West Side black communities in this city of Chicago that I love. But to have heard this so many times for 19 years, I mean, what a journalist does, what I do, what you do, Allison, is we give voice to people who are not being heard. And I think if the victims had not been young black girls, this, you know, Mark Anthony Neal, great African-American scholar, pop culture writer, professor down at Duke, chair of African-American studies, said to me, and this is 15 years ago, "Jim, if it had been one white girl from the suburbs, this would have been done."
You know, I worked in the music business for a long time. You've worked around the music business for a long time. This was an open secret everybody knew something was going on, especially in the music business. So what is it about, I mean, you can blame the courts, all kinds of things, but what was it about the music business that allowed so much of this to continue unquestioned for so long?
Yeah, well, this is one of the things that really haunts me, because you and I, as music lovers, right, is there something particular about music that we embrace the most transgressive people? I'm really wondering about that. I mean, the amount of social media hate that I'm getting, boo-hoo, I'm a big boy, I can take care of myself, that the women are getting, that Tarana Burke, the founder of Me Too, is getting, that the women who founded Mute R. Kelly are getting, that the victims who are putting their names to these accusations. I mean, it is as horrifying to me to see the sexist, vile hatred that is being directed at them on social media as it was to look into the faces on television of those racist, anti-Semitic white men in Charlottesville. I mean, you know, we know there's evil in the world. We know there's hatred in the world. But man, when you're confronted with it, wow. And I don't understand. You know, the people defending Kelly, we don't believe all these liars, gold diggers, many, many names that are much more unrepeatable on the radio. We don't believe it. They're all letting, you know, now it's not even so much that we don't think he did these things. It's that they don't care that he did these things. And which brings us back to what I was saying. They don't care about young black girls. I mean, I know the names of 48 women I write in the book whose lives he seriously damaged, from the point where some of them, you know, considered or attempted suicide. That's not hyperbole to say he ruined their lives, taking their virginity and sexual contact at 14, at 13, at 15. And then on top of that, now they're going to be vilified for having the courage to come forward. I mean, those women are extraordinarily brave. It is about the women, not about this man.
I also, and this is just editorially on my part, so many people make money off of people like this.
It's money. It's all about money.
It's about money, a lot of it.
It's about, Jive Records made $1 billion. I got that from a position, from a source in a position to know the Kelly finances, that Kelly earned $250 million himself, but Clive Calder and Barry Weiss, the men at the top of Jive Records, earned $1 billion. And we cannot say they were unaware, because the court filings in some of the civil lawsuits way back, I'm talking 1996, it starts. The first $10 million suit by an extraordinarily brave woman, Tiffany Hawkins, that tries to stop him, is a $10 million suit. She only gets $250,000, but Jive is named as a party. So there's no way that the top executives of Jive didn't have this on their desk.
My guest is Jim DeRogatis. The name of his book is Soulless, The Case Against R. Kelly. And as you read your book, it's interesting because there's so many different characters, and I feel like the city of Chicago is a character in the book a little bit, down to the way the police reacted, down to great passages about a judge who's got quite an interesting history who has a huge impact on what can and can't be introduced into the one trial. What do you think, what was the role of Chicago in all of this?
Thank you, first of all, for saying that. I hope that long after anybody's interested in R. Kelly, this will be one of those books about Chicago, like, you know, the great Nelson Algren or something. You know, I'm just trying to write about this city that I came to. I grew up in Jersey City. I go to school at NYU, but I've been here since 90, 91, and I love this city. This city has both an incredible sort of boosterism for its hometown heroes. You know, we have the biggest skyscrapers, Allison. We have the most crooked politicians, and we've got the best pizza. I'm still New York on pizza, okay? But there's also this inferiority complex, that notion of the second city, you know, not for nothing. I mean, that's true. We are not New York or L.A., and so in Chicago, we're really super proud of our Michael Jordan, and then we're also like we're not as good, right? And that comes in part from so many people having cut their teeth here in places like Second City or Steppenwolf, and then they become famous, you know, Tina Fey or whatever, and they go to New York or Los Angeles, right? Kelly sells 100 million records, becomes the dominant voice in R&B for a generation, is opening the Winter Olympics and the World Cup in Africa, and he stayed. He didn't leave. He is Chicago, right? I mean, gets vacation home later and gets in trouble in Atlanta and Florida before that. But, I mean, he's Chicago still. You see him all the time. Now, here's the flip side. You see him all the time. You see him cruising Kenwood Academy and Whitney Young High School, both high schools. You see him at the Rock and Roll McDonald's picking up teenagers. You see him at the Evergreen Plaza shopping mall. So he's our hero. He's a superstar. He's among us. And he's among us in the most horrifying, creepy, predatory way.
You, one of the reasons you were able to continue working the story is because you got information over the proverbial transom. The facts came into you. You were on the receiving end of two videotapes with R. Kelly, allegedly having sexual intercourse.
Oh, it's not alleged in the book.
Okay.
It's you know, it's
I'll let you say that.
FBI authenticated. I mean, you know, I knew the girl. We had pictures of the girl. We talked to the girl's aunt, the 14-year-old. I mean, no, it's not. It's
okay.
Not. He should. Yeah. It's. I mean, I think we're past that.
Okay.
And the state
that was actually one of my questions to you. Are we past alleged?
Now has three more. Well, the attorney Damon Dunn, who read every word that I wrote since 2000 to the present, publisher Abrams Books hired Damon, right? You know, Damon is a guy who had no idea who R. Kelly was before November 2000. And, you know, R. Kelly said, I think we are finally libel proof on this man, Jim. Damon Dunn says that. I mean, like, okay, you know, he will kick me the next time I see him for saying that he said that.
So you're on the receiving end of all of this information, of these videotapes. Some of them are pornographic in nature. Did you ever find out who sent any of this material to you? Do you have an inkling of who it might be?
You know, the book lays out for the first time, in part because I was the beneficiary of yet more fortuitous things that came in, this time via Twitter, when I was finishing the book. I mean, you know, during the trial, R. Kelly's defense team, $850 an hour for 6.5 years, four attorneys making that kind of coin to keep him out of jail, you know, alleged a shadowy conspiracy of Barry Hankerson, the manager who made him a star from the very beginning, public announcement to the top of the charts, you know, to 2000, right? You know, even after Kelly, I won't say allegedly, had sex with and illegally married Hankerson's 15-year-old niece, Aaliyah. So there's a conspiracy. It's Hankerson. It's Sparkle, Kelly's protege. He had a hit record with her. She is the aunt of the girl on the videotape for which he was indicted, and somehow me, because the tape comes to me anonymously. I do not know exactly who steered that tape to me. The thing that needs to be understood is the streets of Chicago were lousy with R. Kelly videotapes. After the tape that gets him indicted, actually before, there were tapes there for sale. I bought a DVD compilation of two Kelly sex tapes, not the one that got him indicted, at Tower Records. I still got the price tag on it, $15 on DVD. My reporting partner, Abdon Palish, just gave a guy $10 and got it on VHS at a corner in the Loop, right? Which is like, I'm telling you, we bought it at, you know, at the Battery around Wall Street, right? I mean, it was that visible. There are so many tapes that were out there for so long. They're all dusty now, old and on VHS. The worst kept secret in the universe. Everybody knew Kelly was doing this. It wasn't always clear if the young woman was underage or of age. These tapes were out there. This evidence was out there. This story was out there. Abdon and I felt guilty, and we feel guilty to this day, that even though we ran the first story in 2000, we were already 9 years late, because victim number one, who spoke to me for the first time for this book, Tiffany Hawkins, did not speak to anyone ever before about the lawsuit she filed in 96. You know, her victimization begins at age 15 from 1991, lasts till 1993. That's years before Aaliyah. And the book starts with her. If her name had not been mentioned in that fax you talked about, we would have never started this. I would have never lost these 19 years of my life. And it ends with her. And I just met her this January. She said, I want to tell my story finally now. I want to do it once. and there's nobody else I'd talk to. So when you say, like, these tapes and these facts and these things came to me, I think they came to me because I did that first story right. And I never stopped taking the calls from the young women who called me or emailed me or wrote me. You know, I think we built trust. We built trust, and because Chicago does not trust the police. You know, I mean, we have problems with race in this city, and with some, not all cops. You know, there were white officers, you know, who were investigating Kelly for 2 years. Allison, the pain, you know, I tried for about 5 years to get one of the investigators to talk to me again. He finally did for the book. Man, this thing destroyed him. The things that he saw, like me, the people that he talked to, the pain he heard, and then the thought that Kelly was acquitted. There were people who cared about the young black girls. There were, but there weren't enough, not nearly enough.
Jim, what's going to happen next? What do you think, in your informed opinion?
I have no idea. You know, what happens in this justice system in the United States of America? And I don't really think anything can happen that isn't going to be too little too late. Those 48 women whose names I know, they don't get those parts of their life back. You know, now me as the music critic and professor, the legacy, I got to do an event at WNYC's Green Space on Tuesday night, sitting with the great Tarana Burke. And I believe, you know, that she is a civil rights leader on the order of Malcolm X or Dr. Martin Luther King for this era. The worldwide discussion she has started with Me Too. You know, and I said, I think your legacy above and beyond this conversation that needed to be had that for centuries, you know, is we're going to have to look at the art, all of us. Really, really look at the art and ask, when can we separate the artist and the art? You know, which I think we can do most times. We don't want to impose a moral litmus test on everyone whose art we admire. But then there's a couple of troubling, really troubling, rare exceptions. Woody Allen, maybe,
yeah.
For some, Bill Cosby for others. Michael Jackson is one that's tearing us apart right now. And R. Kelly, because he's never made a secret. From Honey Love to I Admit, he has almost always been talking about what he's doing and also asking for forgiveness from the Lord for those sins.
I have to tell you, I was reading the book on the subway. Lady tapped me on the shoulder, said, "Is that good? I've heard about this. I think I need to read it." I said, "I think you should." My guest is Jim DeRogatis, author of the new book called Soulless, The Case Against R. Kelly. Jim, thank you so much for joining us in all of it.
Thank you, Allison. Thank you for caring.